You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
The rules don't apply specifically to Warren Beatty as a director.
He wants us specifically to know that, and everyone's seen this movie to know that.
We were warned that the rules don't apply.
No, that's true. That was not strong enough of a warning.
It wasn't specific enough.
No.
We were warned throughout, yeah.
Well, before we get started, I just want to introduce Gene here. You guys may know him from his wrestling show, where he both does a podcast with Richard on the site. And Thumbtacks and Screwjobs, and as well as writes the regular wrestling blog.
Hello.
This is his first review, and he's nervous, so be kind. We'll try and get him to actually talk during this.
I'm still trying to process what I saw.
There's a lot to process.
It's a hell of a lot.
Do you remember Chris Herman's first review where he was like so happy to be here and then he was like couldn't say anything?
Oh, yeah.
And well, now the trick is not getting him
we
to
get
talk.
That a lot. I was like that on my first. Yeah. No, I wasn't.
We talked about that because it was also the movie. Because I had the same thing with my first one as well. Which was, mine first was The Nerve, and his was Secret in Their Eyes. It was the movie didn't give you...
Was not the easiest movie in the world to do a review of.
Did I even let you and Martin talk on the first thing we ever did together?
I'm pretty sure you didn't.
Yeah, shut up.
Experience tells me no.
Well, luckily, you've got a lot to, you know, work with in this movie, too.
Well, yeah.
So did Warren Beatty. So much that he tossed in stuff he maybe didn't have to work with.
That is very true.
Oh, yeah.
This is, and Warren Beatty doesn't direct a heck of a lot of movies.
No, he's a very boutique brand.
Yeah, his last directed film was Bulwark back in 1998.
Screenplay nomination for that, though.
But apparently, this has been gesticulating? No,
gestating.
That would mean he was
wildly gesturing. No,
gestating in his head since he made Reds.
Wow. Yes. That was like 1981.
Yeah,
like, Diane Keaton said that's when he started, when they were shooting. Like, I want to do a Howard Hughes movie. And that's where
he finally got around to it. Yeah. I guess he was like, I'm not old enough yet to play Howard Hughes, which didn't stop Leonardo DiCaprio,
clearly.
But, you know. But when you're working with Martin Scorsese, you know, they quite frankly...
Didn't stop that dude in Melvin and Howard either.
They could have cast Haley Joel Osment if Martin Scorsese's directing. Everyone will be like, yeah, whatever.
It's Scorsese.
Yeah, it's Scorsese.
Well, no, that was the first movie he made after he traded Bobby De Niro to the rom-com crowd. And he got Leonardo DiCaprio as payment.
Well, this one is... I felt like the biggest issue I have here is a confusion with who we're supposed to be focusing on, because the movie sells itself initially
held
a poster, you know, as a sort of a meet cute romantic comedy between Alden Ehrenreich, you know, young Han Solo,
yes.
Who did indeed shoot first in this movie as well.
Yeah, well, hey.
as young Frank Forbes, who's just gotten out there to the big city. He's just gotten a job as a driver for Howard Hughes with all his young actresses.
I mean, you know, he moved up from Fresno, but yeah, yes.
Exactly. Yeah,
see, 3.5 hours away.
He didn't go that far. Well, in California, that might as well be New York City, the way people talk about it. You know? And he's just met young Lily Collins, who plays Marla Mabry, an actress from Virginia, who was about to go to Mary Washington College, the school I spent a lot of my formative years having sex with and she's like a good Baptist girl. She's there with her mom, Annette Bening.
And he's a good Methodist boy. I mean, they're like... You know, they are the exact model of people that LA should eat alive, and indeed in the 60s and 70s would go on to, but they're coming just under the wire of the studio system, and they're working for Howard Hughes, who, eccentric though he is very protective of his people, especially the contract starlets that he hires, which are, you know, he is creepily influenced of, to the extent that they all have their own drivers, they each have their own, like, spectacular fucking house that he bought, you know, and their job seems to be really, since he's not making any movies at this point, is to go to dance classes, go to elocution lessons, go to singing lessons.
Just in case they need to be ready for when
get,
you get to
yeah, yeah, get ready for your quote-unquote screen test, which maybe you'll have, and which, you know, there's a little bit of an illusion going like, oh yeah, screen test, that's when Howard sees you.
Yeah.
And yet these two main characters, or at least two main characters what we're introduced to initially, are fresh off the turnip truck, more or less. He's trying to get Howard involved in a real estate deal that he has, that he wants to develop Mulholland Canyon.
No one will ever do that.
Yeah, no one would ever do that. And she just, you know, she was going to go to college, and she won a talent contest, and now she's out here with her mom, played by Mrs. Warren Beatty, yeah, and Annette Bening,
of course,
who, you know, is great to see. She's been as
every time we see a Columbia film, she's there.
That's true. Yeah, it's just like, you know, pretty much.
Yeah, looks just like,
and she's you know, she's definitely she's Baptist stock herself, and she's like living with her daughter, kind of going like, well, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, and as well she should, yes. Because as you said, this seems to be just like Howard wants to have his holding pattern of like young starlets that, at least in this movie, they're not going like, oh, they're just there so I can lech on them. In fact, he won't meet with anybody.
Yeah.
He at this point hasn't kind of gone fully over the edge, but we're seeing him teetering off that edge of like
walking that way.
Yeah, sure. His reclusiveness. He doesn't want to meet with anybody or be seen. Even when he does, it's always
he's in permanent aha gotcha mode, which is like, you know, as soon as he gets even where near to signing something or committing to something, he'll turn right around on you and go, aha, you were trying to get me, and I'm not going to let you.
But that's how I feel that he thinks everybody, the rest of the world is.
Yeah,
that's why
absolutely.
He, like, everyone's going to be like, aha, gotcha to him, and he, that's, you know.
And one of the few really, really wise decisions they made. How long was it into the film before we actually saw him?
At least 20 minutes.
Yeah.
20 to 30 minutes. Yeah. So there was almost like a specter of, you know, I want to say specter? There's this aura about him that in the beginning is like, wow, this guy's eccentric. Seems to lose it by the second half where the movie kind of shifts.
Yeah, it kind of becomes much more about him and Ehrenreich, who's evolved from being just a driver to being his number one personal assistant. Him and Matthew Broderick.
Broderick was his character, really good in this film.
Yes, he was.
Oddly, it's just still weird to me when he's playing the like lecherous guys or whatever. Like here, he's like he isn't given a lot to do, even though he's on screen a lot. But like most times, it's like him insinuating he wants to fuck an actress. You know, even though that's the one role he's not supposed to do. He clearly doesn't have much respect for the system.
He kind of comes off in this movie as, and I don't think it's an intentional choice, but as that, you know, that guy you knew in high school who was gay but would constantly be like, wow, check out the tits on that girl, just to let you know that he was not gay.
Not
me. Not over here.
Little.
Have a girlfriend in Canada.
A little overperforming there.
Yeah.
But I guess where the, like you said, that's where it got weird for me, where I was like, well, the movie takes a really sharp turn away from these two characters who we've spent the bulk of the first, like, you know, more than a third of the
planting
film
the
with,
seeds.
You know, really like, okay, this movie's about these characters. But then it's like, okay, well, we're going to have, like, you know, one of them go away. Like, Lee James, okay, well, I'm leaving. And then it's about Howard Hughes growing more and more insane and God damn, I never can say his name without looking at
Ehrenreich.
Like, yeah. Becoming more and more stoically frustrated.
But that's what you're sort of waiting for when you see a movie featuring or about Howard Hughes, is you're waiting for that moment where his mind just, you know, totally shifts.
But the problem, though, is the bulk of this film is about that, but that's not the film that we're sold.
Well, you know, it's really strange. There have been about, like, at least three, four, maybe even five movies about Howard Hughes, and the eccentricities in the stages of his life.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, most of them always kind of treat it within the framework of some device, like Melvin and Howard. You have like, oh, I'm, you know, surprise, I'm wandering in the desert and I'm going to give you lots of money. you know, and I guess, you know, obviously The Aviator took some of that head on, but for the most part, that was a movie about Howard Hughes as a young man.
Yeah.
And you kind of get a little taste of it at the end.
Yeah, the framework for that movie is Howard Hughes as an old man, not other character.
And this seems to, you know, it's really being sold as if you, you know, look at what the trailers are handing you is that this is, we're going to use Howard uses eccentricities to framework this romantic relationship, and what it ends up is being completely the opposite of, here's your frame, it's these two kids that, you know, are fresh off the boat, so to speak. And then that is your doorway into Howard uses eccentricities.
Correct. And halfway into the second act, you are completely right. I got sold a meet cute, and by Act Two, we're seeing surrogate father or looking for surrogate father story, and it's a sharp turn from a romance story. I don't know if you got that, but that's what
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
I saw the trailer, and I saw the trailer a couple times because I'm a Warren Beatty fan. So many of us are, and so I saw that. The trailer is just as jumbled as the film, so I really, looking back, I'm not surprised that the film went from this to this to this.
Are we going to talk about the scene transition?
Yeah, because the trailer does that, and I thought, well, you know,
he's right. The editing and the scene transitions, which are really jumpy, it feels like a late cut, is what it feels
like.
He spent
a year editing this. This movie was shot in 2014, and they finished, and he edited for about a year.
Well, it sounds like it was overthought.
Yeah, totally.
It does. It jumps around like that. Tonally, it jumps around like crazy. Like I said, from being this kind of cute, frothy little film, but charming, especially with its period stuff, to a film that's not dark, it's just sad.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like sad watching this guy.
Well, you can't make the thing.
I like the frothiness, though.
You can't.
It's playful.
Yeah.
You know?
Me too.
Yeah.
You know, the choosing your framing device, you can't make a happy ending out of a movie whose main character is fucking Howard Hughes.
Well,
you just can't.
You can if he's a side character, which is what
that's why it's that main character. Yeah.
Which is what the movie first act initially is. Yeah. Yes. And I feel like that's the movie I still wanted to see.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
I felt like there were two movies fighting each other here. The first one, the love story was good, but I would love a Howard Hughes movie, cut out all the other stuff, and just maybe be about
I would have sat through a 2.5 hour, you know, straight up fucking Howard Hughes biopic that Warren Beatty did. And I hate to think that maybe he was just like, well, I can't sell it that way because we've already done The Aviator, you know?
Was it really the love story that convincing? Because I didn't buy them at all as a couple. I didn't really think they were that dynamic together.
It wasn't that convincing because they never gave it, like, they never got past the first hurdle. You know what I mean?
If we got more, like you said,
We spent so much time with them building to this point, and then it got to a hurdle, and then the movie's just like, well, that story's done.
But it's a point that's built on this, the two of them having nothing in common but the fact that they're both wide-eyed innocents.
And if you remove
I don't know. They had a lot in common.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I would say so.
They both finished church on Sunday.
And
I think it went further than that. They both work for the same guy. They're both kind of shielded by these weird arbitrary things that he has decided that they have to do.
And as well as things in their own religion.
The religion certainly is a thing. Really they're both trying thing, to be, they're both trying to step out of what they were supposed to be, you know, whatever his track was in Fresno. Her, you know, I was just going to go to college and, you know, maybe try to be sorry. They're both following their dreams. I think they're, you know, and plus, you know, when you get into foxholes with people, you get close to them and they're in a similar situation.
Yeah, but you sort of like, you sort of construct commonalities and common bonds.
I will not disagree that they could have written a lot more scenes showing the two of them like falling in love. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, won't argue with that.
It ultimately comes down to is at the end of the first act, we should know abundantly clear what the conflict is. And I guess in a romance story, it's harder to kind of make the comparison, but it's like basically you remove the villain through the entire second act of an action film. Compare, take it, you know, take that as what it is. make it a romance story. That's what it felt like. One of the big conflicts was removed when she was missing for how long?
Yeah, a giant portion of the film.
25 minutes, well, maybe? Well,
because she's not that interesting of a character to begin with.
I don't know. I mean, I thought they were developing an interesting character.
Yeah, I thought if more time, and they
She has this wonderful scene where she drinks for the first time with a meeting with Howard Hughes. It's a totally charming scene.
Oh, yeah. So that's a badass scene.
Yeah, that proves that Lily Collins has got
There are a lot of things that happen in this movie that you're just going, oh, wow, you know, say what you will. Warren Beatty is a competent film writer or filmmaker. I will say that I really think his reach far extended his grasp here. I think he was trying to make something, you know, as eccentric as Howard Hughes himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he either didn't go far away from that and relied on some stuff that seemed to be safe, or he just literally could not decide what movie he wanted to make.
And it's a shame because his performance as Howard Hughes is dead on perfect.
Oh, absolutely.
Like phenomenal. He nails it.
It's doesn't miss a beat performance-wise.
Oh, yeah, and he gets the whole evolution to the point, like, this guy, like I said, he's an older guy, but he's still kind of got that, like an old Indiana Jones in his bomber jacket, to where he looks like Gollum. You know, the scene towards the end where he's like, you know, where he, which is the framing device where, like, they were trying to get him on the phone to say whether or not the biography, which was in real life fake, you know, whether or not it was fake. You finally see him. He looks like they've just modeled him after that scene where Bilbo, like, gets upset about the ring for a minute, right, and his face turns kind of evil. He looks like that. His lips are kind of black, and you're like, he's really gone. Like, any sense of ego associated with that performance is, like, clear that he's dissociated himself with that. He's not the I gotta be beautiful Warren Beatty actor anymore. He just wants to give a solid performance here and really get as close to being Howard Hughes as he possibly could. But I feel like maybe that was the problem. Maybe that ended up dominating where this film was originally supposed to go.
In a way, it is a love triangle between the three of them. That's for me.
In a way,
what it becomes about, yeah, because they're both like they're both smitten with each other, but they're also smitten with him and what he, you know,
agreed. And the love triangle works when you don't remove one of the sides of corners ends. When you remove it for a majority of the second act.
They keep trying to throw in this subtext about, like, you know, relationships with your father type thing that never feels like it completely plays through. It's, like, there, but it's not there. It's, like, kind of almost an afterthought. Like, well, at one point this was a bigger subtext, but now we're just going to, you know, obviously his relationship with his father was one thing, and he's bothering Alden's character about his father, who he's not interested in talking about. We don't even hear really much anything about Lily Collins. It's kind of like, well, he is in a way a substitute father for her and for Alden.
Is he Phil Collins? That's awesome.
I love it being part of the subtext, but when they try to discuss and bring it to the forefront, that's when it's sort of like
it
falls
becomes
apart.
Troublesome when you're like, where are you going with this?
And it's a good scene. He's great in that scene. Yeah. But
I don't think they thought it all the way through.
Mm. Well, let's go to final thoughts. Frank?
You know, for me, I think besides this movie being a love triangle, it's about two legends, Warren Beatty and Howard Hughes, and how they are both sort of like complex visionaries. And I mean, you know, Warren Beatty's been known to like pore over projects. I remember a story with Maureen Stapleton. He was directing her in Reds, and they didn't like take after take, like almost like two dozen takes of one scene. And
he actually made her join the Communist Party.
And, he was just after every take. He was like, again, until she said, "What are you looking for?" And she ended up winning an Academy Award for her performance. But you know, like Hughes, he's you know eccentric, and you know he probably felt a closer kinship to him than he probably did to Bugsy Siegel or you know Clyde Barrow or any of these larger than life characters.
Sure.
That being said, this film is a problematic film. It has flow and tone and script problems galore. It's got a lot of interesting, you know, familiar faces, but, you know, they're just there really just, you know, to be spotted and nothing else. I can't say I recommend this movie that highly, but it's an experience that I'm glad I had at the same time. I will give this 6 first hangovers out of 10.
Gene?
All the ingredients were there to make a strong film. The actors, I think, really brought, I wouldn't say their A game, but no, I'll say it. They brought their A game. Every issue I had was a pacing, script, and just overall focus. It was just a complete loss of focus halfway in, and I don't know. I would have to say I would give it 6.5 out of 10. What's that stain on your pants?
Bo?
Well, I'm going to use the obvious metaphor, and this whole movie is a lot like the Gossamer Goose, the giant plane that you will see if you go see the movie.
That was the Spruce Goose.
The Spruce Goose, yeah. The Spruce Goose. The H1, which is... you know, it's got a lot of fantastic elements. It looks impressive on the page. It sounds great. And it actually manages to fly, but it really doesn't go anywhere. And that's kind of what we got here. We have this astounding cast, you know, two young up-and-comers, and, like, everybody in the background here is, you know, you've got Oliver Platt, you've got Ed Harris, you've got Steve Coogan, Dabney Coleman, Annette Paul Benning. Sorvino, Annette Bening, people, and they're basically doing walk-ons here. you know, great window dressing for what is an amazing performance by Warren Beatty, but, you know, at the end of it, I'm nowhere, anywhere new than I was when I walked in when it comes to the story of Warren Beatty or to these, you know, two lovers, star-crossed lovers that I'm ostensibly supposed to care about. They kind of drop the ball on them, and they end up, by doing that, dropping the ball on the audience. So I am going to give it... I think there's still some watchable points, so I'm going to give it 5.5 codeine pills out of a bottle.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you guys are saying, totally. This is a casserole with all the most perfect high-quality ingredients, and then you just put, like, way too much cream of mushroom soup in and not enough cheese, you know? I'm also hungry, so maybe that's what I'm going to say. But, yeah, it's pretty to look at. There's so many great performances, and the whole thing is like almost a textbook case of an uneven film. You know, I feel like I know not everyone was with me on loving Hail Caesar by the Coen brothers, and I understood why that wasn't everybody's.
I dug it.
I did too. Yeah. I just thought it was wonderful, but
and one of the reasons I loved it was Aaron Reich's performance.
But and that too is a lot of like sort of, you know, golden age of Hollywood type stuff. I love all that. But there, at least, I could see what their mission statement was. I understood what they were trying to do.
It didn't lose focus.
It didn't lose focus. It was like, okay, I totally get where this thing is going. This one, I just, even at the end, I was like, so what were you even trying to do with this movie? It's such a shame because there's just so much here that was good. It feels like you could go back, someone else could go back and re-edit this film and make a pretty damn good film out of it.
Oh, I completely agree.
But as is, yeah, it's a bad recipe. You know, it's there must have been a misprint somewhere. You know, I'm just saying, don't use internet recipes unless you've double checked them.
Hold the garlic.
Yeah. I give it 6 out of 10 bottles of urine.
Oh,
yeah, so I'm surprised nobody else took that one.
I'm surprised no one said banana nut.
Yeah, banana putt. Yeah, because he likes the banana nut ice cream.
I never want to hear banana nut ice cream.
He just likes bad ice cream, like banana nut, actually, like rum banana raisin. Nut,
yeah. Not rum raisin. I can't get behind.
Either one of those. Yeah, I'm hungry, and I'd
me be too. Like, no, me too. I'll turn that down though.